You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Good morning, friend. Welcome into the Mike Allen Show here on this Wednesday, November 16th. My pleasure to be with you. Hope you're doing well this morning. T-minus 8 days away until Thanksgiving Day. So look forward to that. Hopefully give some thought this year to going to Mass. Love to go into Mass on Thanksgiving Day, of course. If you're going to be scrambling around that day, getting a meal together may be tough, but was mentioned the other day, you know, the word Eucharist means thanksgiving. So wholly appropriate to go and give thanks to the one from whom all blessings flow. Looking forward to the blessing of the next couple of hours. At the bottom of the hour, my guest, live from the Eternal City from Rome, John L. Allen Jr., the editor of Crux and a longtime Catholic journalist, follows all things Catholic, I think, the most credible English-speaking journalist in the Catholic world, in my opinion. We'll be talking a little bit about the meeting of the U.S. bishops, which took place, their annual meeting in Baltimore just the last couple of days, and they had their own presidential election a week after our nation did the same thing, in which they elected, as was expected, Cardinal Daniel DiNardo, the Archbishop of the Archdiocese of Galveston, Houston, an archdiocese that has two cathedrals, which is not completely unheard of. Anyway, but Cardinal DiNardo taking over as president. He was vice president from our friend Archbishop Joseph Kurtz, who's been on the show many times. Don't know if we'll have the same media access to Cardinal DiNardo, but maybe now that Archbishop Kurtz is less busy, we can get him to get on the show a little bit more often. And then the vice president of this three-year term was Jose Gomez, the Archbishop of Los Angeles. So we'll get John Allen's take on that, if he sees anything significant in that development and anything else that John Allen is covering. I want to pick his brain a little bit on an interesting piece I think he wrote after the election of Donald Trump on three ways, you know, despite misgivings about the papal presidential relationship, which definitely had a tinge of frost back during the campaign, particularly when Pope Francis made his remarks about not building walls, but building bridges. John Allen, nonetheless, inveterate optimist that he is, being a Midwest Kansas farm boy, will give you that kind of spirit. Anyway, he has listed at least three ways he sees Francis and Trump being able to work together. So we'll talk to him about that. And then in my second hour, I'm going to have Martin Cothran back on. I had Martin on a couple of weeks ago. He was talking about, at the time when we interviewed him, why he could not vote for Donald Trump, which many might, you know, find that to be a surprise, because Martin Cothran has this sort of caricatured image for those who know him as a hardline conservative, but he's not, as it is with most people. He's much more complex than you think. And Martin, though, wants to weigh in on a reflection on why, yes, we were surprised, perhaps, by the Donald Trump election. By the way, Cothran also said he could not vote for Hillary Clinton, so he was like me in that regard. But anyway, he says there was actually a Greek philosopher a few millennia ago who predicted it, the Trump victory, if only we had been paying attention. So we'll talk to him about that, which should be interesting. Some other things we'll get into today. Of course, the scripture readings, as we try to do most days. Also, an article I didn't get to yesterday, Cutting and the Confessional, and why he won and she didn't, in particular talking about the Clintons. If you want to join in and be a part of the program anytime today, 573-4-BREAD-4, 573-4-BREAD-4, or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com, or post your response to Facebook or on Twitter. Hope you had a good day yesterday after I left you. I had a good day in many ways. A good day for the mouth, not so good for the waistline. Left here and had no breakfast. Succumbed to temptation. the McDonald's drive-thru. Number one with a Coke. Is there anything else? The Egg Mac. And then around lunchtime, somebody, when I went over to teach my one class at the Catholic High School, somebody had brought in, I don't know if it was leftovers for the faculty, these big tins of food, including this delicious concoction of fried calamari and peppers all mixed up. And I just stood there with fork in hand and feasted on that. And then last night, not in any mood to cook clean dishes, so the fam and I went out and I had dinner. Well, it was a greatly reduced fam, several of our kids out of town. Makes it a little easier to go out to eat when you're taking five out instead of eight. Went over to Schlotsky's. Love me a good Schlotsky sandwich if you've never had it on this sourdough bread. So I'm going to have to try to make up for that today. Not good. And then, but last night, of course, got to sit down and enjoy watching my Kentucky Wildcats thump Michigan State, which was nice last night. Basketball season is officially here. And it was the early game, so I thought I'm going to get to go to bed early tonight. And then I get a call from my wife, who had run up to the high school just down the road to pick up my son after coming back from a choir trip. And in our big 1997 former Public City vehicle red van that we've had for 10 years now, I guess. Anyway, I guess she had picked up my son, stopped by her church office to get something. She's the youth coordinator at our parish, called me because she had locked all the keys in the van with the engine running. This was at 10:30. I was already in my PJs. I wish I could tell you that I reacted with great poise and grace and sweetness in that moment, but I guess that'll be something to take to confessional. I did not. But, you know, dutiful as I was, went over there not knowing how we were going to get into this vehicle, thinking I was going to have to call some sort of roadside assistance. But to my wife, got to give her credit. She will surprise you. She put together some weird device with a pool stick out of the youth center there at the parish and some sort of small little elbow piece of PVC pipe and was able to snake that through a side window, go down and hit the unlock button, and all was good. So, like I said, you never know with my wife. I remember years ago, we went through this phase with our boys when they were like 2 and 3 years old, where my three-year-old son at the time took great delight in flushing things down the toilet. And whether it was a bar of soap or a toy from his Happy Meal or, a sock, those sorts of things. And I remember one time I was doing dishes in the kitchen, and I heard, when you hear silence, when you got two boys, a 2 and a 3-year-old, not to mention our older children, in the house, and you hear silence, that's not a good sign because it means they're plotting something. All of a sudden, I heard the toilet flush, and I heard my 3-year-old son, Bruce, say to my 2-year-old son, Ryan, Bruce used to call Ryan BB, which I guess was like baby. He goes, "Look, BB, it went down." So I went running in the bathroom too late. We went through this phase where we had to call plumbers on the reg, let's just say, when something would be wedged down deep in the toilet. And this was in the days before YouTube, by the way, where you could figure things out. And so one time I was out at a meeting and my sons did this again, and my wife, knowing that I would not be in the best of spirits, that she'd had to call a plumber, actually pulled the toilet herself. My little petite wife pulled the toilet herself, unclogged it, and it was all good to go. So, like I said, you never know with her. But anyway, doing all right today. Thanks for asking. Well, you didn't, but, power of imagination anyway. The readings for today were in the book of Revelation, as I said. This vision of St. John that he had on the Isle of Patmos, of really the veil pulled back that he could see reality. See, this is, again, while we really need to understand the book of Revelation not as some sort of futuristic dream of what we're hoping will happen one day. I mean, there's an element of that, right? But the book of Revelation was written as a great source of strength and courage to suffering Christians in the first century. it was not a sign of the victory to come, the book of Revelation, a dream or a hope of what would happen one day when Christ returns. It was meant to be a correction to the reality that they assumed was true via their eyes, that they could see the victory that had already been won in Christ and was made present to them, actually, every time they gathered together for the liturgy. The book of Revelation, very much a liturgical book, made sense, that makes sense when we see it through the lens of the Mass. As I said, Scott Hahn's book, The Lamb's Supper, must reading in this regard. And this vision today he has in the book of Revelation, chapter 4, come up here and I will show you what must happen afterwards. At once I was caught up in spirit, a throne was there in heaven, and on the throne sat one whose appearance sparkled like jasper and carnelian. Then he sees 24 other thrones, the 24 elders sitting there dressed in white garments, thrones, flashes, around the throne was flashes of lightning, rumblings, peals of thunder. It's having a theophany of sorts, an encounter with God manifesting himself. And then in the center of the throne, with these strange creatures gathered around and the 24 elders, what does he hear? Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty, who was and is and is to come. The same Sanctus, the holy, holy, holy that we sing in every Mass, an affirmation that in the Mass, heaven is touching earth, and the ultimate victory that has been won, that is yet to be revealed, the veil still there. We enter into it. More on this later, but have faith, little ones. It is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. We'll be back in just a minute. This is the Mike Allen Show.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Minutes past the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show here on Breadbox Media. Good things are happening over here at Breadbox Media if you want to check it out. What we're about, breadboxmedia.com, including, as I said, the opportunity to have parish streams. You know, we stream live. We have these apps for digital devices so you can carry Breadbox Media in your pocket. We also offer this opportunity for parishes to have their own stream, so you get the same programming, same contributors from every corner of this country and across the heartland, daily and weekend shows, which are full of, current news, strong theology, accompanying of each of us together, an honesty that we're seeking to grow in Christ, imperfect as we are, and to find the most complete expression of truth found in the Catholic faith. That's what Breadbox Media is all about. But parishes who get their own stream can take those three-minute commercial breaks every quarter hour and use it however they want, for a communication hub for their parish, for good teaching, for advertisers from within their parish, the kind that are on the back of the bulletin, for example, who want to advertise. And the parish will receive half the revenue from that from those advertisements. So it's really good opportunities all around. Check it out at breadboxmedia.com. You can also listen to podcasts, share the good word with others about what you found at Breadbox, and help us keep the soul train here going. 573-4-BREAD-4 if you want to call. My question of the day, you know, sometimes I ask deep questions, and it's crickets, sometimes more superficial ones, and I get a lot of play. So let's go superficial. I had a great, the other night I went out to dinner. Someone had given us a gift card, very, very kind. And my wife and I went out to really one of the best restaurants in Lexington. Been around for years and years and years, called the Merrick Inn. And I got there, what for me is their signature dish. I mean, a lot of things you can get there, steaks and all the rest. But I got their fried chicken, and their fried chicken is to die for. I think the last time I ate there was about 15 years ago. They have not missed a beat. And what I really like about their fried chicken, and it's not cheap, of course, but, you know, you get what you pay for, is kind of takes me back to childhood again. They bring these little things of honey with the chicken. That takes me back when I was probably like 7 years old and my father taking us out to Frisch's. It's a pretty rare treat to go out to eat, but we'd go to Frisch's. And I'd always order the fried chicken, and they always brought a little thing of honey with it. Chicken with a little honey on it. That's, boy, good. And I'd kind of forgotten about that until I had fried chicken at Merrick Inn, and they brought me the little honey, and very, very tasty. So I'm asking a question about fried chicken today. Let's say there's a fried chicken bucket, and you're the first one to it. All right, it's got 8 pieces, the standard chicken bucket, let's just say. What are you going for first? What piece are you grabbing? Now, come on. We'll set selfless you aside for a minute. You're not thinking about anybody else. It's like the story of the two boys sitting there eating pizza, and there was one piece left, and they were arguing over it, and the mother said, "Now, you know, Billy and Joey, I want you to look at that piece of pizza, and I want you to think about for just a minute, what would Jesus do?" Whereas Billy thought for a minute, looked at Joey and said, "Joey, you be Jesus," and Billy grabbed the pizza. So you let everybody else be Jesus. You're getting the piece of chicken you want. What piece are you going for? 573-4BREAD-4, or email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com, or you can post a thought on Facebook or on Twitter. Comments we've gotten so far, by the way, Mike Allen Show the handle. Tom says, leg, easiest to eat fast. There was a time in my life I think I would have said the leg, too. Patricia says, wing. It's interesting. I mean, I like a good wing. It's the least meat on the chicken. But a wing is good. Christy says, breast. Now, that's more up my alley. Now, I understand. Sometimes, depending on how well it's fried, that breast may be dry, but I love a chicken breast. Kate says legs. She's going to toe two, double-fisted, I guess. One leg in each hand. Sort of a miniature Henry VIII. So what are you going with? I mean, fried chicken in my book is up there with bacon as about the perfect food. Yes, I know. Not good for the waistline. 573-4BREAD-4. You can be healthy another day. Today you found the bucket of fried chicken. So would love to hear from you on that. Sports-wise, as I said, the Champions Classic, the NCAA basketball season getting started. And when you're a Kentucky football fan, believe me, you look forward to college basketball. College football not always quite as fun. Anyway, and so I stayed up last night and watched my Cats go up against Michigan State. Tom Izzo, who seems to, by and large, has had Kentucky's number over the years, I'm sure his record is probably, I can only think of one or two losses that the man has had against Kentucky, the number of times they've played. So I didn't know what to think. We've got, as always with John Calipari coaching, a very freshman-dominated team, but a very, very fast team. One of the fastest teams that I've seen at Kentucky. And they put that speed to good use. Excellent guard play. Freshman had a great shooting night, Malik Monk. And they won big. Now poised to move from number 2 to number 1 because Duke, who was number 1, squaring off against Kansas. Now, in all fairness, Duke is missing 3 of their plum recruits from their freshman class, which is considered one of the best in the country. And they dropped on a last-second shot to Kansas, who had lost their first game. So I guess this means my Kentucky Wildcats will now move up to number 1, which, so I was telling Alex, I'm not sure that's a good thing. I mean, believe me, I understand that. That sounds a little condescending to be negative about a number 1 ranking, but I'm afraid our freshmen will let it go to their heads. But I guess it's a risk worth taking. Anyway, for the time being, we'll see how the rest of the season unfolds. There was an interesting article I saw yesterday that ESPN that said basically, and when it comes to college basketball these days, it's Duke and Kentucky and then everybody else. And they're mainly basing that on recruiting, in which
John Calipari and Mike Krzyzewski seem to now dominate the recruiting rankings every year. And in college basketball, that really does make a huge difference. So we'll see if it plays out that way this year. Other big news last night, between the two games of the Champions Classic, the football poll, the top four, the playoff poll being released. And if you are a Louisville Cardinal football fan who thought numbers 2, 3, and 4 losing would pave the way for your ascendancy into the football playoff, think again. Because the committee came out last night with their top four. Ohio State moves up from 6th, I believe it was, or 5th, to 2nd. And Michigan, which was 2nd, only dropped one spot with their loss on the road at Iowa. And Clemson, which lost at home to a fair to middling Pittsburgh team, only moved from 3 to 4. So Louisville still on the outside looking in with not a lot of opportunity to win their way into the top four. They play a decent Houston squad whose season hasn't unfolded quite like they thought it would on the road. And then they host my Kentucky Wildcats in a game that we're going to feel like that they need to score 80, and they just may do it. Who knows? But, you know, the logic of the committee, I guess, was that Louisville lost to Clemson head-to-head, so they went with that angle rather than the fact that Louisville's one loss is a better loss than Clemson's one loss, because Louisville lost on the road in a nail-biter to a top-five team. But I guess Clemson has some quality wins, maybe in terms of opponent, that Louisville does not have. So I think what Louisville, you know, needs to happen is, probably ideal for Louisville, quite honestly, would be if Michigan were to beat Ohio State, because Ohio State would then not make the Big Ten championship game, because if assuming Penn State wins out. So then you've got Michigan moving up, Clemson moving up perhaps, and then Louisville potentially moving up there to 4th. So there's still a lot of game action to go, but if you're a Louisville fan, that's got to be pretty hard to see last night. 573-4BREAD-4, give us a call if you've got a comment or a question. 573-4BREAD-4, or email me. Maybe you think the college football ranking system, which, you know, all it does, expanding to 4, it just moves the arguments down one space. Okay, let's real quick sneak in some What Were You Thinking awards for the day. Go dumb or go home, as we like to say. Celebrating the, well, not the best and the worst of humanity. We're just going with the worst this time. Now, this from Rock Hill, South Carolina. Man sprayed Axe body spray into his mouth during a DUI stop. He was spotted after he was pulled over by officers spraying Axe body spray all over himself and even into his mouth. Isn't there alcohol in Axe body spray? I'm not sure it had the desired effect. The second nominee, we're going to go to, let's see, I know we've got one here. Oh, yeah, this El Segundo police in California. So they finally caught the air horn guy, and residents rejoice. This guy's been blasting an air horn at 4 a.m. every morning. Let me tell you, that guy better be thankful the police got to him first. People don't like being woken up at 4 a.m. They might have just found limbs separated and placed in various parts around with an air horn blasted in celebration. But the winner goes to the woman who bet $223,000 on Hillary Clinton beating Donald Trump in the U.S. election, despite never gambling before. Didn't work out too well. Anyway, we'll be back with John Allen of Crux Now. This is the Mike Allen Show. You're listening to Breadbox Media.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
We're
We're right at the bottom of the hour. You're back on the Mike Allen Show here on this Wednesday, November 16th. Pleased to have with us, live from Rome, John L. Allen Jr., the editor of Crux, specializing in coverage of the Vatican and the Catholic Church. He's written 9 books on the Vatican and Catholic affairs. Also a popular speaker on Catholicism, both in the U.S. and internationally. The London Tablet has called him the most authoritative writer on Vatican affairs in the English language. And he's left his home in Colorado and is back in Rome through the end of the Jubilee Year of Mercy. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Mike. Although I have to say, you're right. I have left home in Denver, but it always feels like I have come home here in Rome because I lived here for a decade, and this place feels like my second home. So always good to be here.
Well, that's wonderful. Well, yesterday, the U.S. bishops had a big election of their own. Everybody's still abuzz, of course, about the presidential election here in the United States, but the U.S. bishops, Archbishop Joseph Kurtz, who's been a semi-regular guest on this show, finishing up his 3-year term, I think, to pretty positive reviews, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is probably difficult, Mike, to find a single landmark accomplishment that will go down in history as Kurtz's legacy. But I think what is fair to say is that during a very difficult time for the conference, I mean, obviously there were significant issues, for example, with the White House, the fight over the contraception mandates and other issues. A time when the conference itself was trying to find its way under a new pope and so on. And there were a lot of shocks to the system. He led the conference with great calm and with great good humor. And in my view, that's his defining characteristic. He is that guy in every room that no matter what nuttiness is going on, you can count on him to keep a level head, to keep smiling, to reassure everybody it's going to be okay and kind of lead the way forward. And I think that's what he's done for the U.S. bishops for 3 years.
There is a bit of herding cats kind of challenge. I mean, you got very strong personalities, each with their own particular.
It's a room full of alpha males, Mike. In getting those guys together on anything is very difficult. Building consensus is always a challenge, and Kurtz does that exceptionally well, as does the guy who's going to be taking over for him, Cardinal Daniel DiNardo of Galveston, Houston. Although, of course, the big headline from yesterday's election at the USCCB wasn't so much that DiNardo was chosen to be president because, as you know, informally, almost always, the vice president is elected to become president. DiNardo had been vice president, and he won on the first ballot as president. The big headline, I think, was the selection of Archbishop Jose Gomez of Los Angeles as the vice president, because that race was genuinely wide open, and I think it made a clear statement about where the bishops are coming from.
Yeah, and I want to get to that statement. Let's talk for a minute about Cardinal DiNardo. Is it, I know there was your colleague Inez has a piece up in which DiNardo is quoted as saying, to call his election, because there had been some speculation that this was going to be a statement from the bishops against Pope Francis, let's just say, or, opposing in some measures of Francis's papacy. DiNardo says that's ridiculous to even say that. And I have some sympathy to his argument because, as you said, it's fairly standard fare to move the vice president up to the presidency.
Well, look, I mean, in DiNardo, in that interview, which is available on the Crux site, he says it is true that both he and Gomez of Los Angeles would conventionally be seen as a little bit more conservative or a little bit more traditional. But his point is, what he's challenging is the idea that being traditional means you have to be anti-Pope Francis. He insists that both he and Gomez are extraordinarily positive about Francis and what he is doing for the church. And therefore, he is saying that this and of course, we live in a hyper-political age, Mike, and where everybody reads everything through the lens of left v. right. But his argument is that that's not at all what was going on in this vote, and that if somebody wants to see this as some kind of repudiation of Francis by the American bishops, the word he uses is crazy. He said that is just simply flat out crazy.
Do you anticipate that he will have as president, will he have a clear agenda of what he wants to accomplish?
Well, you know, what incoming presidents of the conference always say, of course, and it's a bit like what popes always say, that they don't bring their own agenda, that this agenda is going to be worked out collaboratively, will be the agenda of the conference. And that's all true. I mean, you know, the bishops just voted in a new statement about their priorities, and I'm sure DiNardo will make a good faith effort to uphold that. But on the other hand, remember what I said about alpha males in Cardinal DiNardo. While a lovely man, is clearly an alpha male who has his own strong sense of what he believes in, what he thinks is important. And he talks a bit about that in his Crux interview today, because, of course, we asked him that question. And he ticked off three issues that he thinks would be particularly important for him. A couple of them aren't very surprising. He says he's going to be committed to the bishop's pro-life agenda, which means, of course, opposing an expansion of abortion rights, continuing to fight for the conscientious objection, continuing to fight the issue with the contraception mandates. Then he mentions immigration. That's another obvious one, a matter of clear political and pastoral concern. Maybe the one that comes a little bit more out of left field, Mike, although if you think about the context of Texas, it makes sense, was prison reform. He said he would really like to use this position as president of the conference to make the argument for reform, for more humane treatment of prisoners, for better conditions in prisons, and that ultimately all of that would lead also to making the case for abolition of the death penalty. And if you think about the size of Texas prisons and the sheer percentage of the population that's incarcerated, and of course the fact that the death penalty in Texas, you can understand why all of that is a matter of such concern to Cardinal DiNardo.
Mm-hmm. We're here with John L. Allen, the editor of the Crux website, talking about the U.S. Bishop's election yesterday, in which they elected Cardinal DiNardo, Daniel DiNardo of Galveston, Houston, as the president, and Jose Gomez as the president-elect, the Archbishop of Los Angeles. So let's talk about Gomez for just a minute what you see his election. You say it's a strong voice on the immigration issue?
Well, sure. I mean, you know, if you look at it just symbolically, you know, 1 week ago, the United States elected a new president who ran on a promise to deport undocumented immigrants in this country, to build a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border, and to significantly tighten standards for entering into the country. 1 week later, the U.S. bishops elect as their new leader a man who was himself born in Mexico, who is an immigrant in the United States, and who has spent the last several years becoming increasingly outspoken and increasingly passionate about immigrant rights. I mean, if you can't get the symbolism of that choice in the context of what just happened in the United States, then you're not paying attention.
Do you think that signals, too? Because you also wrote a piece about how, you know, a Trump presidency could shift the focus of the bishops. I mean, in almost that whoever the president is, the bishops are going to have a mission that is a prophetic witness against those issues in an era in which really neither party fully encapsulates Catholic teaching, that it's going to be what they have to, in a sense, oppose or be a witness for against the prevailing presidential current.
Yeah, I think it works like this, Mike. The bishops have been anti-abortion and pro-immigrant for a long time. But also for a long time, the anti-abortion element of their agenda has gotten more attention, both in terms of how the media covers the bishops and also probably allocation of their internal resources, because the perception was that what was going on in the culture, and particularly what was going on in Washington and in terms of the political scene, made the pro-life fight the top burner agenda item. I think what may happen during the Trump years, now, of course, it remains to be seen whether he will deliver on some of the pro-life promises that he made. But it is obvious that issues such as immigration, the social safety net in this country, environmental protection, and particularly the fight against climate change, those sorts of issues are likely to define the tensions between the bishops and the White House. So they will invest proportionately more resources in them, and they will get a lot more media coverage. So I don't know what this is going to do. It's not necessarily going to shift the bishop's agenda, but I think it will shift the way the culture sees that agenda. And probably we will move into an era in which the bishops are no longer seen exclusively as sort of the chaplains of the political right in America.
You know, obviously, as we kind of mentioned, in terms of the different strong personalities, the alpha males, as you called them, of all the bishops, I wonder how, if there was any sort of latent tension there, because in the midst of this presidential election, I mean, you had bishops who came out with their own very different statements. Some of them were sort of thinly veiled, not mandates, but certainly urging their people to what seemed like a thinly veiled challenge to vote Republican, others who were very outspoken against Mr. Trump. Do you think those kind of things percolate their way into their exchanges at the U.S. bishops meeting?
Oh, absolutely. Now, you will never see those conversations during the televised and public portion of the bishops' conference, because let's remember, this is a gentleman's club. They don't like to air their dirty laundry in
sure.
public unless they absolutely have to.
John, I just realized we're about out of time for this segment. Can you hold on?
Yeah, absolutely.
For a few minutes? Okay, fantastic, John. I really appreciate it. Snuck up on me there. We'll be back here in just a minute with more. If you've got a question or comment, 573-4BREAD-4, 573-4BREAD-4. We'll be back with John L. Allen, Jr., the editor of Crux. This is The Mike Allen Show. You're listening to Breadbox Media.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Fifteen minutes before the hour, you're back on The Mike Allen Show. Here with my guest, John L. Allen, Jr., the editor of Crux, live from Rome. John, thanks for holding on through the break.
No worries. What was that music you were just playing, by the way? That was terrific.
You know what? I don't even know.
Producer has excellent taste. Pass that on.
Hey, Alex, you got good taste. He's giving the thumbs up. So we were talking a little bit about bishops not wanting to sort of air their differences in public, but they're definitely there.
Oh, sure. And listen, I mean, you know, these guys are very conscious. You, before we went to break, you gave the example of bishops who had sent different signals in the run-up to the election. Some of them sort of nod in a wink saying, vote Republican. Some of them sort of, you know, the Democrats are cool too. And they are very well aware that when a bishop in one diocese says something like that, it puts pressure on all the rest of them to respond to it. And so when the perception is that they don't have their act together, it creates headaches for everyone. And so, you know, when they get together in these meetings, and of course the bishops in the United States get together twice a year, in the fall in Baltimore and the June meeting that rotates, when they get together, you know, they're obviously going to talk that stuff out. It typically happens more behind closed doors, you know, over breakfast in the hotel, over coffee breaks, things like that. But obviously, yes, those conversations are going on.
And if anybody is disillusioned by the ideas of bishops being in conflict, they need to read up a little church history.
Oh, well, for God's sake. And this goes all the way back to the New Testament, right? The conflicts between Peter and Paul. I mean, look, here's the thing. You know, bishops, like other kinds of Catholics, care passionately about the church, and their political outlook, their life experience, their spirituality has all kind of informed their sense of where the church ought to be going. And, you know, as we've been talking about, they're also strong personalities. Most of them have been in leadership their entire lives, and they have a sense that usually they know what they're doing. And you know, you add all that up and you put them all into the same room. Obviously, there are going to be disagreements and tensions. Remember, Mike, the famous line from Aquinas, right? That grace builds on nature. It doesn't cancel it out. The fact that there is something supernatural about the church does not make it any less human. And if you want to see a biannual display of that humanity, just watch the Bishop's Conference.
That's great. I always make a game when I watch the live stream, see if I could find my bishop or my former bishop, or saw Bishop Barron sitting out there this year. So that was pretty cool.
So what, this is your version of like looking for license plates when you're driving down the highway?
That's right. Or where's Waldo, I guess you could call it.
Yeah.
You know, you're there in Rome, from, among other things, of course, the close of the year of mercy. I always laugh a little bit about that. We're closing the doors of mercy.
Mercy is over now. Yeah.
We're inaugurating the year of harsh judgment.
Yeah.
But of course, you're also there. There'll be a consistory with the elevating or the, you know, the giving the red hat in popular parlance, naming the new set of cardinals, including three from the U.S. And we were talking about a little bit off the air, you know, that, you know, you had, in a sense, some sort of, well, I play Supich, not necessarily a surprise pick out of Chicago, but Tobin, who's just been transferred to Newark, New Jersey, and Kevin Farrell, who will be taking over an office there in Rome. But, you know, there are sort of traditional cardinal sees like Los Angeles and Philadelphia that have been passed over, and that maybe, you know, there were some... you know, a little bit of consternation amongst some of the bishops about that. The thing that I find interesting is that, you know, you didn't have a Blaise Supich or a Tobin even on the ballot for vice president. Was that surprising?
No, I mean, you know, bear in mind, of course, the way that list of 10 candidates is generated is that the bishops are polled. They're allowed to nominate up to five other bishops. And then you take the top names on the list and those become your 10. You know, I think for one thing, Blaise Supich hasn't been in Chicago very long. You know, Joe Tobin, although he's been in Indianapolis a few years, has had a fairly low profile there. So part of it is they're probably just not as well known among many of their other bishops as some of these other figures. And, you know, I think the other thing is I think two facts are true. Okay. Supich and Tobin in particular would represent leaders of what you might call the progressive wing of the American bishops. So that's fact number one. Fact number two, and the results of the elections yesterday confirmed it, is that as of right now, conservatives are still a majority in the U.S. Bishops Conference. So I don't think it's particularly surprising, Mike, that, you know, two of the more clearly identifiable progressives would not be the guys this group would nominate it as its leadership.
Hmm. You had a very positive article a few days ago. You know, there was a lot of course, consternation, still is, over the election of Donald Trump, what it means for the Catholic Church, and particularly, you know, the famous dust up between Trump and Pope Francis during his visit to Mexico earlier this year, and the whole exchange about building walls and bridges and all that. You try to take a more, as you call it, a counterintuitive look. Maybe what are some areas that President Trump and Pope Francis can see eye to eye on? Maybe list those three for us and talk about them.
Sure. Well, I mean, you know, first of all, although I think it is probably fair to say that there are obviously going to be tensions between a Trump administration and the Vatican under Pope Francis. You know, this is not the Vatican's first rodeo, Mike. I mean, you know, they have seen monarchies and empires and fascist regimes come and go. And, you know, however challenging you may think Donald Trump is, I'm not sure his run at the White House is going to be up there with, say, Benito Mussolini or someone like that in terms of, you know, making the Vatican nervous.
Or even the guy in the Philippines right now.
Find ways to try to work with whoever is in power to try to do something constructive. And I think there are some areas in which there is a potential meeting of the minds here. You know, candidate Trump, at least, vowed to be very tough on ISIS and try to defend Christians in the Middle East. That is a subject of real concern to the Holy See these days. They're worried that Christianity in the Middle East may be going extinct. And that certainly is an area where the administration and the Vatican might be able to join forces. Pope Francis, as you probably know, and this is the second point, has been very outspoken about what he sees as the threat of gender theory, meaning the idea that gender is not given in biology, but that it's socially constructed. And he has criticized Western governments and NGOs who try to ram that down the throat of developing nations, dangling financial aid to get them to change their traditional values. Now, that again is something that Trump clearly does not support and might be willing to launch a review of American overseas aid programs to try to make sure that we're not doing that. And then the third area that I pointed out in the article is religious freedom. You know, Trump has, of course, vowed to get rid of the contraception mandates as part of getting rid of Obamacare generally. On the campaign trail, he promised that religious freedom would, and respect for it would be front and center in his administration. That, too, is something that Pope Francis has talked about a great deal. It's part of his staple rhetoric now everywhere he goes in the world. So, you know, at least in those three areas, it would seem plausible to think that there's some common ground. And let's also be clear, both sides have an incentive for reaching it. You know, the Vatican is the world's most important soft power, to use that language of Nye, you know, the most important voice of conscience. It's the only world religion that has its own sovereign status and its own diplomatic corps. And, you know, from Trump, from the point of view of any American politician, you know, Catholics are important. And he knows very well that he got elected in part on the support of religious voters. And, you know, so there's some Catholic credit in the bank. And if there's one thing Donald Trump understands, Mike, it's debt. He understands he is in debt to Catholic voters. And so the Vatican might have some leverage to get him to pay up.
Yeah, I wonder if there's any, you know, concern at the Vatican, as you said. You know, it's not the Vatican's first rodeo. You've got a situation over in the Philippines with the president there who, you know, is a very strong demagogic kind of leader. You know, you've got Donald Trump. There seems to be a sort of right wing populism that's gaining traction, certainly globally, you know, and that has to be of some concern, I would think.
Oh, sure. In the same way that the left-wing demagogic and populist wave that swept through Latin America in the 80s and 90s that gave us Hugo Chavez and Evo Morales and so on, that was also of concern to the Vatican. So, you know, obviously they are aware this is going on. They are aware it poses challenges. But again, I say you were talking about an institution with 2,000 years of history that, politically speaking, has not only seen but has lived through pretty much everything under the sun. And my guess is that with great calm, people in the Vatican Secretariat of State, which is where the diplomatic sausage is ground, you know, right now are going through, you know, what Trump said as a candidate and his background, trying to find areas where they want to make a general challenge and also trying to find areas where they can work together. I will say this, that the big thing that will determine early on how that relationship goes, of course, is when President-elect Trump designates his choice as ambassador to the Holy See. That's the first decision a president has to make that affects this relationship. And if Trump comes up with somebody serious who is appreciated by the Vatican, that would set the right tone.
John, we're about out of time. Always appreciate it. Maybe we could all take a cue from the Vatican in the midst of tumultuous times, or even St. Padre Pio. Pray, hope, and don't worry.
Never bad advice.
All right, John, thank you so much. Thanks for your great work. Have a great Thanksgiving, okay?
You too, Mike. Talk to you soon.
All right. We'll be back in just a minute with a new hour. This is The Mike Allen Show. You're listening to Breadbox Media.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.